KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Information, check out finalcafe.com.
You can also get more information at our website, KUOW.org. Click on events at the top of the page.
We're always going on and on about creativity. In fact, we don't know what we're talking about.
When you start to study it and start to try to figure out what it is and specify its constituents, it becomes more and more and more confusing. Nobody agrees on what it is.
The truth about creativity. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
And that comes your way Sunday night at 7 o'clock. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services, a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington. I'm Andy Hurst. Cloudy skies, rain, 51 degrees in Seattle at 10:01.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Ceasefire talks are underway in the Egyptian capital to end the week-long violence between Israel and Gaza's Hamas militants. All sides are expressing cautious optimism that a deal can be forged soon. But Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says, if not, his country is prepared to fight on if it continues to be targeted with rocket fire.
If stronger military action proves necessary to stop the constant barrage of rockets, Israel will not hesitate to do what is necessary to defend our people.
President Obama has sent Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to the Middle East. The White House says Mr. Obama has also spoken again to Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi about the progress of the ceasefire negotiations. Britain is the latest country after France, Turkey, and six Gulf states to recognize a coalition of opposition groups in Syria as the sole legitimate representative of the Syrian people. Larry Miller reports the coalition will have a political representative in the UK, and Britain will help the opposition set up political and humanitarian structures.
Foreign Secretary William Hague told Parliament he was assured by the Syrian opposition it will be a moderate political force and would not repeat the abuses of the Assad government.
It is strongly in the interests of Syria, of the wider region, and of the United Kingdom that we support them and deny space to extremist groups.
Hague says Britain will send a stabilization response team to the region to help the coalition meet basic needs in areas held by the opposition. He also says he expects the U.S. to recognize the Syrian opposition. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
A new Quinnipiac poll says New Yorkers give high marks to almost everyone's response to Superstorm Sandy. NPR's Margo Adler reports all the politicians get high grades, especially New Jersey Governor Chris Christie.
89% of New Yorkers said Christie's response was excellent or good. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo got 85%, President Obama got 84%, and Mayor Bloomberg got 75%. More than three-quarters of those polled blamed climate change for the storm. 62% blamed climate change on burning fossil fuels, and a big majority said the federal government should spend billions to protect New York. Various relief agencies and organizations, the Red Cross, the MTA, got high marks. Even gas rationing got wide approval. Only the utility companies fell short. Of the almost 1,200 people surveyed, just 37% felt they had done a good job. Margo Adler, NPR News, New York.
Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke says 2013 could be a very good year for the U.S. economy if Congress reaches a deal quickly to avert the so-called fiscal cliff. This hour, he is addressing the Economic Club of New York. At last check on Wall Street, Dow was off 24 points. At 12,769, NASDAQ down 7, S&P 500 off 2. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from CSX, transporting 2 billion pounds of goods to market by train and working to help move the economy forward. CSX, how tomorrow moves.
Clouds and showers, 51 degrees right now in the U District. We're expecting a high today of 52. Forecast says chance of rain this morning, increasing showers later today. It's going to be cloudy and rainy tonight and tomorrow. Tonight's low in the mid-40s, tomorrow's high in the upper 40s.
We are fully supportive of Israel's right to defend itself from missiles landing on people's homes.
I do store chips. If I chip up branches or things like that, which are great to have on hand.
Most of the time, thank you is almost perfunctory. and sometimes heartfelt, but it is a response to something that happens in the moment.
The three interfaith amigos joining us to talk about why gratitude is such a big part of this season. Also, we'll talk gardening in a little bit as we wrap up. We lay to rest our gardens for the winter, somewhat. But we start with what's happening in the Middle East. As you heard, there is closer chances of a ceasefire here. Israeli and Palestinian forces talking about a ceasefire. Egyptian President, Hamas, Ban Ki-moon, Secretary of State Clinton, all trying to come up with a ceasefire, along with the Turkish delegates. Everybody's involved in this right now. Joel Migdal is a professor at the Jackson School at the University of Washington, director of the Interdisciplinary Near and Middle East Studies PhD program. Specialty is Third World Development, Middle East, Arab-Israeli conflict. And after all these years, to be a specialist in the Arab-Israeli conflict is, I don't know, it's a little bit like building grand and ever-changing and elaborate buildings, isn't it? It's Byzantine.
It's something you can never escape.
Yeah, it's always with you. All right, well, sounds like we're close to a ceasefire. What would prompt them after escalating like this? What's the political benefit from them coming up with a ceasefire right now on both sides? Hamas, or all three sides? I guess we could include the Fatah in that too.
Well, from the Israeli point of view, they have two main goals here. One is to stop the rockets that are falling mostly on their southern, small southern communities. And second, they feel that they, after the 2009 Gaza war, they were able to establish deterrence. That means that they were able to say to Hamas, you receive such a blow, you know now, you better not hit us again. But that begins to wear off after a while, and they feel they have to reestablish deterrence as the rockets got greater in number. From Hamas's point of view, they are looking for a couple of things. One is an end to this destruction. The infrastructure destruction is tremendous in Gaza, and it's starting all over again after the rebuilding effort after 2009.
Had they succeeded in some rebuilding?
Yes. Yes, there was a lot of rebuilding going on. But also, they are engaged in an interesting dance with a number of different players, right? They have recently broken with Syria, which was a long-time ally. They have established their credentials in the Sunni part of the Arab world. They are also dancing with Fatah, which governs the West Bank, and trying to establish themselves as the preeminent Palestinian representative or voice. And so they have a number of political and military goals that they're trying to achieve here.
Why would they want the better rockets that they got smuggled in through Egypt, is what we're told?
Well, they felt that in the last war, Israel had ways of constantly ratcheting up the pressure on them, escalating in international relations terms. First by airstrikes, then more airstrikes, then a ground invasion, targeted killings, and that they had no way to do that. They had one bullet in their gun, and that was these rockets that they fired, which were pretty inaccurate. Two things happened. One, the Israelis received this so-called Iron Dome. They built this Iron Dome together with help of the United States, which is an anti-missile defense system, which made the rockets even less effective. And second, they were looking for a way that they could ratchet up, respond to escalation or escalate themselves if they felt that this would be in their interest. And with bigger and better rockets, you can reach communities like Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. And the Israelis immediately said, you have now changed the rules of the game. Soon as the first rocket was fired at Tel Aviv, the Israelis said, you have changed the rules of the game.
Did they? I mean, did they change it to their favor, Hamas?
Well, I think they certainly got the attention of the Israelis. Yeah, I think that they increased the pressure. The Israeli government, by all means, does not want Jerusalem and Tel Aviv struck. This is the heart of where the population is. Oh, excuse me. And
we never should have put that cabinet there.
Sorry. And And they feel, this is upping the pressure on Israel for sure.
Joel Migdal is our guest. So does it, by upping the pressure, does it destabilize the area, or is it solidifying, you know, deterrence can have a positive effect, right? Because it makes both sides wary of moving forward.
Right. Well, I think it helped both the Israeli threat of a land invasion and the escalation of rockets to the center of Israel push the parties into ceasefire negotiations faster than they might have otherwise wanted to go. So it did have an effect.
Was Israel interested? I mean, they're gearing and they're massing for a ground invasion, and they still, you know, we don't know what's going to happen. But do they want that? I mean, does Netanyahu think that he would strike a blow and push Hamas back a few years?
It's hard to say. Khaled Meshal, the head of Hamas, the political head of Hamas, was goading Netanyahu yesterday. Come on, get your land invasion, then you'll lose the election, meaning there are going to be Israeli casualties, and then you're going to suffer from this. Let's see if you have the guts to do it. It almost sounds like a playground brawl, doesn't it?
Yes.
On the other hand, I think Netanyahu's view of this is Israel has changed its calculations since 2009. It no longer believes that it can defeat Hamas. In 2009, it believed a land invasion could actually upend them.
Oh.
It no longer believes that. Most people no longer believe that. I think there are a few in government who do, but the main leaders don't believe that. So the question
because it has so much support of the population.
Well, partly because they go into hiding. They are not they don't have a well-developed infrastructure anyway, so they can sort of pop up again after this is all over. And Israel doesn't want to occupy Gaza again. So they sort of wait Israel out in hiding in bunkers or wherever they hide. They don't have any shortage of recruits because there is support among a segment of the population for them. So what does Israel want then? If it's not going to be able to defeat them, what do you want? And I think what they want is to establish an equilibrium which allows Israel to continue on its way now, to live its life without rockets being fired at its population, without having to fear what's going on in the Gaza Strip. And they think that a strong sock in the nose is especially for Hamas now, which is more established than it was in the past, is going to show them you don't want to do this.
I see, because there's a political cost that Hamas would pay.
Right. There's one interpretation. You know, the military chief of Hamas was assassinated in a strike. Now, some people had called him Israel's subcontractor. That means that for the last 3 years, he has been reining in radical groups and preventing them from firing rockets into Israel, which is in Israel's interest. So he's been called Israel's subcontractor, you know, on a kind of informal basis. Obviously, he's not working for Israel at all. When the rockets began to come in greater and greater number, Israel hit him, I think very purposely, saying, you're not doing your job. And this is a message to Hamas by striking him explicitly.
Wow. Joel Migdal studies the Middle East, travels there, professor at the Jackson School at the UW. So what does Hamas want at this point? Not just with the ceasefire, but I mean the broader question. What are they looking for vis-a-vis Israel, but also the West Bank and Mahmoud Abbas?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, if you ask them what they want, they'll tell you right away. We want an end to the occupation, okay? Now, for them, occupation is a very nebulous word. It means the end of the blockade of Gaza, and it means the end of any role for the Israelis in the West Bank, but in their explicit ideology, it also means the end of Israel. End of occupation means that Palestinians should control all of Palestine. So obviously they're not going to get that in any short order, any of those things? Are they going to get in short order? So I think what they're looking to do now is establish themselves as the primary, as the address for the Palestinians. Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestine Authority, is losing popularity. Hamas is gaining a foothold in the West Bank as now an addition to Gaza. They feel that with the new Egyptian regime, that is, Hamas, by the way, is originally an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood of Egypt. So they are very closely related. Now, they haven't been totally happy with President Morsi of Egypt since he came into office. He has actually done some things they don't like. But in the long run, they think that they are in a better strategic position now because of the kind of Islamic awakening of Sunni Arabs in Tunisia and especially in Egypt that puts them in the position to be the spokesman for the Palestinians.
And in terms of the West Bank, why would Israel seemingly continue policies that would strengthen Hamas in the West Bank?
Right. So
I'm asking a rational question for an irrational answer. I mean, there's no real rational way to answer that.
Well, you know, there's one way which I often tell my students is if you think of Sesame Street and Bert and Ernie, right? And Bert says to Ernie, "The window is broken. You have to fix that window." And Ernie says, "I can't fix that window. It's raining outside." And the next day, Bert says to Ernie, "You know, it's sunny now. Go out and fix the window. What do we need the window fixed? It's sunny outside." Now, Israel's position is that it wants a two-state solution and it's ready to deal with the Palestine Authority. It also is very comfortable now. There have been no terrorist attacks to speak of in Israel in a long, long time. Rockets were not falling until very recently from the Gaza border, and the Lebanese border with Hezbollah is totally quiet since 2006, 6 years of quiet. So for Israelis, I was just telling you I was there this summer, they're living a very comfortable life. It's as if an occupation is not existing 15 miles away. And therefore, there is not a tremendous motivation. It's one of those sunny days, why fix the window, right? And when it's raining, like now, where a war is going on, they're saying, we're not going to deal under duress, right? This is not the time to deal. So for Israel, I think there is a real desire for peace and an agreement, but not a tremendous motivation to confront all the opposition to it and pay the costs for that.
What's the implication of what's happening in Syria on this question, but maybe on the greater stability for Israel?
Well, on this question, I don't think what's happening in Syria has much relevance. Israel is watching this situation carefully. I think it does believe that there is a chance that Hezbollah is going to be weakened by what's happening in Syria. And it definitely feels that Iran is being weakened by what's happening in Syria, because Iran basically had a bloc that included Hamas, Hezbollah on the Mediterranean, Syria, parts of Iraq, and into Iran, all the way from the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean, this bloc, and it's fallen apart. Hamas is no longer with them. Hezbollah is shaky. Syria is a mess. So from Israel's point of view, that's good. On the other hand, Israel is not looking forward to internecine communal war right on its border and its possibility of spilling over. Now, some rockets have fallen in Israel this week.
Right.
And Israel, for the first time, fired an anti-tank rocket, I think purposely not to hit anything, but it was a kind of shot over the bow, saying, keep this out of here. So I think Israel is quite worried about what's going on in Syria, watching warily, but I don't think it has much relevance to the Hamas situation right now.
All right. You said two things before, and I have two questions for you. You said that the narrative here, the narrative we get in the media, would you say two different planets?
Yeah. Well, not from the media, from the two sides. The story, why is Israel in this war? If you ask Israelis, we're in this war because rockets are falling on our children, and that's what governments do, is protect us. That's the reason this war exists. And if you ask Hamas and Palestinians why is this war going on, it's because Israel is occupying Palestine. And this is an intolerable situation. They have created a cage in which we live. We have no way of getting in, out. We have to dig these tunnels. That's why there is a war. And you know, each of them also has these kind of secondary narratives, and these are shared narratives. So one secondary narrative is the Israeli election is coming up. And you heard both from Palestinians and Israelis that this is not unrelated, that the Israeli election, that this is solidifying Netanyahu's position, and this is the timing. Certainly he's not fighting the war because of his election, but the timing certainly helps his election. That's one other narrative you hear. I don't put much credence in it. And you hear another one about Hamas, you know, that Hamas is both sort of feeling its oats in the ways I described before, but it's also worried because it's no longer the symbol of resistance. It is now living next to Israel and sort of playing ball with Israel a lot of the time, even in these negotiations. So many small radical groups have grown inside Gaza, challenging Hamas, and Hamas sees this as a way to kind of reestablish its position as the site of resistance.
You've studied this. You decided that this would be the issue you would study. Do you ever just say, maybe I'll garden for a little while?
Every book I've done on this topic, I said, that's the last on the Middle East. And it's no good. By the way, if I could put a plug in, I've just finished a book on the U.S. in the Middle East.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's still,
is it out?
No, it's not out. It's got to go into production. It'll be out in 2013. But called Shifting Sands.
Yeah? Are you assessing the Obama administration in that?
Yes, and the Bush administration. It looks from since World War II, and it looks at how the U.S. saw itself as a player in the Middle East. And the Bush administration, starting after 9/11, made a major, major change in the U.S. position in the Middle East. We saw that in the Iraq War and other ways. And I'm looking at the Obama administration and then sort of ending with what I think we should be doing.
Good. When's that out?
And sometime in 2013, we'll see.
Come back and we'll do a whole discussion on that?
Sounds like fun.
All right. Have a happy Thanksgiving.
You too.
Joel Migdal is professor at the Jackson School, University of Washington, director of the Interdisciplinary Near and Middle East Studies Program, specializing in third world development, the Middle East, and the Arab-Israeli conflict. This is Weekday.
Clouds and rain, 51 degrees right now in Seattle. We're expecting a high of 52. It's going to be cloudy, rainy, and windy the rest of today. In fact, the National Weather Service has issued a wind advisory in effect from noon today, lasting until 6 o'clock tonight. It's going to be cloudy and rainy, a little bit breezy tonight, the low in the mid-40s, cloudy, rainy, and breezy again tomorrow, the high in the upper 40s. Good morning, it's 10:24. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information.
Support for KUOW comes from Soaring Heart Natural Sleep Company, wishing the best to all this holiday season. Soaring Heart believes in helping to create and support healthy, thriving communities. More information online at soaringheart.com.
Hewlett Packard, such a household name, we only have to say HP. Been around so long, though, that maybe it's run its course?
Our goal is simple, a better outcome for customers at reduced cost for HP.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Meg Whitman begs to differ, and now she's running the place. A conversation from the corner office at Hewlett-Packard is coming up next time on Marketplace from APM.
That story and more coming up tonight at 6:30.
Coming up, our gardening experts join us at the bottom of the hour. You can call 206-543-5869. Well, a little more than creeping up the other side of the hour. You can call us at 206-543-5869 with questions for Willie Galloway, for Deborah Prinzer. That's coming up, Prinzing. But first,
part of the Thanksgiving tradition is feeling thankful, having gratitude for all the wonderful things in our lives, even as we look around, if things aren't always so wonderful. That's part of the tradition. Imam Jamal Rahman is co-founder and Muslim Sufi minister at Interfaith Community Sanctuary, also adjunct faculty at Seattle University. Rabbi Ted Falcon is a teacher of Jewish meditation and spirituality. He's also founder of Makom Or Shalom, a synagogue in Los Angeles, and Bet Aleph Meditative Synagogue in Seattle. And Pastor Don McKenzie is a former minister, head of the staff, University Congregational United Church of Christ in Seattle. Together they are the three interfaith amigos. Katie Sewell talked to them.
I talked to them about gratitude and what to make of it if we are not feeling very happy with our lives at the moment. I started by asking them to explain the difference between thanking someone for something and the spiritual practice of gratitude. And Rabbi Ted Falcon was the first to answer.
Most of the time, thank you is almost perfunctory and sometimes heartfelt, but it is a response to something that happens in the moment. I think gratitude is a bigger category that represents the expression of an open heart, where we become grateful not only for a particular event, but for being present at a particular time, for being with the people we are with, and being able to perceive the beauty and the goodness in our world.
You're nodding, Jamal.
Yes. I would say in the traditions there is a difference between expressing thanks and gratitude to the small g and the big G, meaning the giver and the real giver. And the story in the traditions is that if someone gives me a very expensive hat or a very beautiful hat to wear, I must thank the person, the small giver. But I must also thank the big giver who made me the head to put the hat on. And that is a practice of gratitude.
So how does this apply to people who are not religious and thinking about gratitude in a God sense?
You know, we like to say everybody really believes in something higher than human personality. And I love this story of this atheist who tells his son, there is no God. And the son who's trained to question says, Father, how do you know? And the father says, son, you've got to take it on faith. So we say that even atheists and agnostics, they believe in something we call God, truth, justice, compassion. You're giving thanks to this energy of universal truth, compassion, humanity, and that's God.
So how does that manifest into an actual spiritual practice? Give me an example of what you're doing if you're expressing gratitude in a spiritual way. Don, do you want to try?
Well, let me quote Rabbi Ted, who has taught us the Jewish spiritual practice of awakening and thanking God for having our souls restored and being faithful to us and giving us another day. And he often quotes the Christian mystic Meister Eckhart, who said if the only spiritual practice you had was to say thank you, that would be enough. And so I think what we say to each other is that gratitude is a frame for almost all spiritual practices in a way. I mean, and that's what Rabbi Ted and Imam Jamal were saying earlier, that gratitude is a sensibility. It's a way of understanding experience that goes beyond the moment of saying thank you. Saying thank you can click into something good, but doesn't always lead to anything else. But we need that sense of being able to frame our lives with our blessings. If we do that, we can cope with our curses. But if we frame our lives with curses, as we often do, then our blessings, we have no access to them.
Many of our teachers will say, we think that if we're happy, then we're grateful. But the reality is, when we're grateful, we're happy.
Is it somewhat the difference between being an optimist and a pessimist, or is that totally different?
I would say it's different. Gratitude is a way of being in the world, a way of receiving and perceiving our reality. One of the simplest spiritual practices, and this follows from what Pastor Don was saying about Meister Eckhart, is to have a practice of saying thank you, even, you know, to use that as a meditation, so that any thought that arises in the mind, the response is simply thank you. Any feeling that arises, thank you. To take that thank you at the end of the day and whatever we remember from the day to meet it with thank you, even if it's the kind of thing that stirs us to upset, to say thank you and to discover what can we learn, what can we appreciate, how can we avoid, you know, the feelings that we might have dipped into during that day that were difficult for us or difficult for others. So thank you becomes a basic orientation to the world. The difficulty of having a day called Thanksgiving is like having a day dedicated to compassion. It's like so much attention goes into doing it that we sometimes miss the very thing that we're aiming for. Thanksgiving has to be all the time. So that the day of Thanksgiving is a special way of recognizing that, reinforcing that. Sitting around the table and looking at all the people who are there and just allowing yourself to be thankful. Whoever's there, the right people.
There's a very wonderful verse in the Quran that says that everything which dwells upon the earth and heavens extols the limitless glory of God. So there is a universal vibration of gratitude. Even Pythagoras said a stone is nothing more than frozen music, its vibration. So when we are expressing gratitude, as my brothers have said, it's a state of being, we become aligned, our personalities become aligned with a universal vibration. And that makes us more centered, more uplifted, more joyous. You know, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, he said, look at a bird. Even a bird, when it sips water, it tilts its neck backwards, not only for the water to flow down, but for praise and gratitude to flow heavenward. Everybody and everything is praising, and we want to tap into that universal vibration.
And part of the real difficulty comes when we look out at our world or we look out at our personal experience, and things are not happening that we feel really grateful about. Things are not happening the way we would wish. People are killing each other. There's violence. There's hatred. And how do we be grateful for that? And that is where having gratitude as a spiritual practice comes into play, where we can't be grateful that all that's going on. But we can add gratitude as an energy to the environment we share, to do what we can not to get caught up in that hatred and in that the break up, to support the wholeness of each individual being and of all peoples.
Did you want to add something to that, Don?
Well, I think I certainly agree with what Rabbi Ted said. One day for Thanksgiving is it's a good start, but it's not what we need. Thanksgiving Day is really about family and being together with people you care about. And there is gratitude in that. But gratitude needs to become that way of understanding experience that can, I hate to use the word only, and I should be cautioned this, but really spiritual practices using thank you or gratitude as a frame is so necessary to moving from that place where it's hard to see our blessings to a place where even our curses are things we can actually be thankful for, as my colleagues have said.
But the really big question is, how can we be grateful if bad things are happening to good people? How do you tell someone, be grateful if one's life has been savaged by life circumstances? So that's a big mystery. There's no answer to that. But to me, the greater mystery is, and I've seen this with my clients, with my congregants, that those people who have been so betrayed by God and they want therapy, but they say, please, never mention the word God. And I don't. But as they go through the process of healing and they move from being a victim to a survivor to someone who is empowered, they become the world's greatest God lovers. And the only story I can think of is in the Islamic tradition, is where a Bedouin was asked, do you believe in the all-compassionate God? Are you grateful? And he said, do you mean the God who sent me illnesses, poverty, afflictions, made me wander from country to country to country? But as he spoke, he entered into a state of ecstasy. That is a greater mystery.
I'm speaking with the three interfaith amigos, Imam Jamal Rahman, Rabbi Ted Falcon, Pastor Don McKenzie, about gratitude since Thanksgiving's right around the corner. We figured it was a good time to talk about it. So let me ask the question. If I am a person listening and I'm really, really having a bad year, whatever life circumstances are on my plate right now, there's nothing that I would be ever wish upon my worst enemy. Where do you even begin to start to foster this kind of thinking?
You know, the first thing I would say to such a person is honor the nature of the experience you're having now. And you might become aware of even the wonder of being able to have any experience at all, you know, of seeing, of feeling, of thinking. And then use your imagination to create a situation for which you would be grateful, just to start that energy moving within you. Like, what could happen that would draw gratitude from you? What would you be? What would you think? What would you feel? And step into that imaginary situation if you don't have at hand a quote-unquote real situation, and start that energy of gratefulness operating within your consciousness, opening your heart. And you might be surprised at the things you begin to perceive. And it's important not to deny any negative feelings and not to discount any negative feelings and not to try to get out of them, but just to notice that there are other things going on as well.
Don, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, the only thing I would add is that even though we're saying these things, we've each been in that place you described, where we've had a bad day, a bad week, a bad month, a bad year, a bad series of years, a bad life. No, not a bad life. I mean, we've all had too many blessings for that. But we've not only had those days, but we've been privy to the moments when people in our congregations have shared those kinds of experiences. So those difficult, negative, frustrating things are absolutely real. And what Rabbi Ted just said was he described a path to come back from resentment to gratitude. And resentment is that distant country that is described in the prodigal son. We have to get ourselves back, and spiritual practices, the kinds of things we're talking about, are tools to help us do that.
Jamal, do you have a suggestion for a simple gratitude practice for people to try?
Oh, absolutely. One of the most favorite practices is to keep the focus on the heart. Because as in other traditions in Islam, they say that God is outside of you and inside of you. God cannot be contained in the space of the earth or the heavens, but God can be contained in the space of the pure, loving heart. So in good times or bad times, if one is remembering always to keep one's focus, attention on this mysterious heart space, and continuously using one's own words, tell the heart, "I love you," with feeling, or "Thank you. I'm so grateful. I am so thankful." Prophet Muhammad was asked the same question. He said, in good times, he says, "Thank you, God, because it is your grace that brings all things to perfection." In bad times, he would say, "Thank you, God, under all conditions." Find a technique which suits your personality.
There's blessing within Jewish tradition that even when bad things happen, one says words of blessing. Blessed are you, Holy One of all being, that one who awakens within each one of us as our God, universal creative presence, the ultimate judge. You know, where I can't know from my standpoint the bigger picture. I can't deny my specific experience, but it may be part of something greater and larger. And it is possible to include even that in a field of blessing.
Three interfaith amigos speaking to us about gratitude: Imam Jamal Rahman, Rabbi Ted Falcon, and Pastor Don McKenzie. Thanks all for coming in.
Thank you, Katie. We are grateful.
This is Weekday.
It's coming up on 1040. I'm Andy Hurst. State Senator Ed Murray is the new majority leader in the Washington State Senate, but he faces some tough challenges, including a $900 million budget hole, a Supreme Court ruling that requires full funding of basic K through 12 education, and a possible rebellion by conservative Democrats. Ed Murray sits down with KUOW's David Hyde this afternoon at 12:20.
Support for KUOW comes from UW College of Education in conjunction with the Danforth Leadership Program, recruiting educators to join a leadership development program. Information session November 27th, UW Campus, Miller Hall. Details online at education.washington.edu/Danforth.
On the next Radio Lab.
If you tell me the average speed of walking in some city X...
And only the walking speed?
That's right. I can tell you how much crime there is in the city. The average wage, number of theaters, number of colleges, the population, and the number of AIDS cases it's going to have this year.
Taking the pulse of a city. That's on the next Radio Lab. Join us.
And that comes your way Friday night at 7 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Repertory Theater, presenting Tennessee Williams' classic, The Glass Menagerie. An aging Southern belle longs for her youth and dreams of a better life for her children. Now playing through December 2nd. Tickets on sale at seattlerep.org.
Clouds and rain, 51 degrees in Seattle, working towards a high of 52. Forecast says it's going to be cloudy, rainy, and very windy the rest of today. Same for tonight and tomorrow, cloudy, rainy, and windy. Tonight's low in the mid-40s, tomorrow's high in the upper 40s.
And now we garden. But you know what? Willie and Greg and Marty, they're all out partying already. But Deborah Prinzing is here. Thank you for you know,
oh, those
filling
slackers.
In. Those slackers decide that Thanksgiving starts early. No, they're excellent people.
Actually, Marty just emailed me from the train. She's returning from Eugene today, where she spoke last night.
Oh, that's right.
But couldn't get back fast enough for you.
No, but I'm glad you're here.
Thank you.
Deborah Prinzing is a garden, home, and design writer for the Los Angeles Times, Sunset, Better Homes and Garden. She's author of The 50-Mile Bouquet, which we shall take up today. You brought in a beautiful bouquet, all from within,
Northwest.
Northwest.
Mm-hmm. I'd say about 180 miles.
Because you went to Eugene for some of these.
Yes.
All right, let's pick the things that you got locally. What is in this bouquet?
Well,
this is autumn, and so...
Oh, there's so much available in people's gardens, and the crab apple.
You have to have your thought that way.
You have to think like a flower farmer and look at every potential element of your garden as something that could go in a vase. And you have to be experimental, because sometimes things aren't happy in a vase, but you don't know until you try, so...
So you have this is Calicarpa... Some kind.
The beauty berry.
Purple berries. Is it happy in a vase?
Yes. It's great. I mean, I think this was probably cut over a week ago.
Really?
So they hold on to their berries. The crab apple, I recycled this, Steve. This was in another vase a couple weeks ago.
And so you just took a branch of a crab apple that had crab apples still on it.
I actually got that from a jello mold farm in Mount Vernon, and the farmer at the Diane Sukavati and her husband Dennis Westfall, she's on the cover of the 50-Mile Bouquet. They're my patrons. They always bring me goodies.
Can I just ask, so you must have written about this then, is it Jell-O Mold Farm because they have Jell-O molds like over there?
Do you remember that building down in Belltown that was covered with copper Jell-O molds back
yes.
in the day?
Yes.
So Diane had a landscaping business, and she did the landscape there and is responsible for that crazy installation. So it's followed her.
That's good.
Yeah,
all right, so the dogwoods, what kind of dogwood is that?
Diane and Dennis grew this in Mount Vernon, too. It's a very straight dogwood, and if we pull it out, you'll see that it's really cool. It starts kind of orange, and then it goes to dark red.
It's going to fall apart. This lovely bouquet will fall apart.
It's called Fire, and there's lots of different colors of dogwood. There's dark burgundy, there's bright orange, there's pink. So that's kind of a great element for people who really want to be local and not...
I have a yellow now that is bright.
It lasts forever in a vase.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Because you need to cut the stems
every week and put them back in. The willow, the curly willow, which is also was grown in Oregon, but it, there's lots of sources for it in Washington too, it will root. And it has a slight antiseptic quality. So a lot of designers just put willow in their vases to keep the water clean. You know, you see it in arrangements, and it's sort
really?
Of nice, natural.
Now, this color of this curly willow, this orange, this is...
It's pretty.
Is it a special kind, or is it just the time of year?
No, I don't know the cultivar, but it was grown by Charles Little in Eugene, who is a longtime permaculture flower farmer. Everything he has is shrubs more than, you know, perennials. So he just has a great farm.
Permaculture farmer. Permaculture flower farmer. How widespread is that?
I don't think people do it. They don't label it that. But really, the nice thing, what the way Charles described it to me, and I've wrote about this in the 50 Mile Bouquet, is that he uses a lot of woody shrubs that can be harvested year after year. So he's not having to have this labor-intensive planting. When his shrub rows are young, he'll put annuals and perennials between them. But then as those shrubs get larger, he'll shift those other crops.
But he is making a living as being a permaculture perennial flower.
He is.
Farmer.
And he and his wife sell at the Portland Farmers Market in, you know, many parts of the year, mainly in the fall. And they have U-pick for weddings. So bridal parties will go to the farm and cut their own bouquets, which is kind of a retro trend that's returning. I love it.
And he gets pruning done.
Absolutely.
All right. So there's a eucalyptus in
there? Charles also grew the eucalyptus. This variety is called Gunny Eye. And I
small leaves.
It is. And I love the red stem. See how dark the stem is?
Oh.
So it's more interesting than kind of your rounded leaf.
Does it have a eucalyptus-y smell?
I can't tell. You know, that mainly comes from the sap. So I don't know if we...
Oh, is that right?
We'd still smell it a little bit. My car smells great.
Oh, no, it's got it. I broke a leaf. It's got it in there. Yeah. But the reason I couldn't tell is because you have this amazing... This is a scented geranium. It's curly leaf.
It's a variegated
leaf.
Yeah, a variegated scented geranium or pelargonium.
And I've been rubbing my fingers on it since you came in, and so now it's all I can smell.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's like when you rub basil and you, or a tomato leaf, it just brings you the scent of the season. This geranium wouldn't last. We wouldn't winter over outdoors, but I think that they grow them in high tunnels, which is just enough protection to keep them from succumbing to frost.
In further south, in Eugene.
Down by Mount Pisgah in Eugene.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But they're all of these ingredients, and we should take a photo of this with my iPhone and put it on your Facebook page, but all of these are available through the Seattle Wholesale Growers Market Cooperative in Georgetown. That's when you don't have time to clip in your own garden, that's an option.
All right, I want to talk about that, but one more thing. You have these are what? These are lilies?
They're Asiatic lilies. They are hothouse grown.
One is opening up.
I had it indoors yesterday trying to, you know, warm it up. But this is great. Steve, look at how many buds are there. There's probably 15 buds. There are only 3 stems of lily. So you're going to have flowers through the holiday weekend. Succession blooming. This is a dark orange one, but it's got some interesting kind of burgundy flecks inside on its throat. So that'll look good with all the other sort of reddish burgundy touches.
What is... this time of year, what was just this iris? If you went to that to buy this, I mean...
The lily.
Lily. What would this cost? Just these 12, what do you got, two or three stems in there?
If you were able to buy these 3 stems and they were grown by a local farmer, you would pay $9 for the bunch. But with that many buds on it, and you can add greenery from your own garden or twigs from your own garden, you know, you're getting, I mean, this it's like a $50 arrangement.
Well, I love the idea of going out in your garden, and I guess I love the idea of the permaculture perennial flower farmer.
Mm-hmm.
You may have given me my next career.
Next time you're heading to Eugene, I'll send you to visit. It's pretty cool. One of the things that we photographed in the 50 Mile Bouquet, David Perry photographed it for at that farm, was that Charles had he had a field of onions, and he felt like there was... He wanted to go up and double his use of that space. So he put trellising in and grew his sweet peas coming up from the onion patch. And we just were mesmerized by that vision of an edible with the floral together and utilizing space in a sustainable and efficient way. Like he's not wasting his land.
Can you use sweet peas in a bouquet without them just getting crushed?
Oh, sweet peas?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. The thing about sweet peas, because they trellis up, they climb up, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
If you cut, the more you cut them, the more they produce until it gets super hot. So, you know, there are people who just plant lots and lots of them and, you know, can create bouquets every day.
You're just delicate with the stems.
Yeah, they're not long stems. They're probably 10 inches long. You have to go down to the base of each branch and cut them. So they're little posies.
I gotcha. Right, I was taking the whole plant. I see. You're just
Well, you could do the whole plant. That would be stunning for like a wedding or a beautiful, you know, gala event, but they wouldn't necessarily last that long.
Yeah. No, but I see. Water. I get you. I see. All right, so as you say, Seattle Wholesale Growers Market, 10 to noon on Fridays, but then what, holidays are open? Oh, 10 to noon tomorrow.
Right. So the Seattle Wholesale Growers Market is a cooperative of flower farmers in Oregon and Washington, and they sell direct to the florist, and they're doing incredibly well. They're down in Georgetown and on Airport Way South. So it's a wholesale market. It's for people who have, you know, businesses like florists and wedding designers and restaurants. But they decided to start opening on Fridays to sell their surplus inventory at the end of the week to the DIY floral designer like you.
Yeah, like me.
Because it's the holiday week, I just wanted to let people know that they can shop there from 10 to 2 tomorrow and get amazing tabletop decorations for Thanksgiving or for later into December.
All right, so tell me something. A month from now, Christmas time, what are you going to, what would be your raw materials?
My go-to floral plants?
Yeah.
Well, I have two categories. One are bulbs, which, you know, I know they're not what you maybe would think of as cut flowers, but I grow a lot of amaryllis. I've started them right now. The bulbs are in all the garden centers. And if you plant them now, they'll be blooming by the end of December. I just put them in bowls of potting soil and I let them grow in the container on my tabletop. Some people cut them. They're very expensive on the floral trade cut because imagine how many bulbs you have to go through to get a big bunch. But one stem is good enough for me. And paper whites. That's another thing that's very fun to do. And just put three in a little flower pot and now it'll be blooming at Christmas. My other favorites are really the storms help me out, Steve. You know, the Sitka spruce on my neighbor's property is knocking branches down.
So you like to use a lot of the conifers and evergreens mixed in.
Yeah, and I forage them. I don't even have to buy them. They come. I live in Seward Park. It's a lot of big, tall evergreens. So those are really fun to put in. It was sort of a larger arrangement, like a big, you know, urn or something like that.
I see. So it has some space.
Junipers, cedars, the Sitka spruce, the deodoras, there's every. I mean, those look. They last indoors for about 2 weeks before drying out.
Excuse me, I knew that was going to happen. That was me sticking my nose into that into that geranium there. I apologize. Do you clip some things and save them? For example, this crab apple. I mean, when did you clip this?
I've had that crab apple for a month.
Yeah,
and I bought three stems from Jellamold Farm. I probably paid about, I don't know, $7 for those stems. I use them in a different arrangement that I did for a photo shoot. And I thought, I wonder how long these beautiful, I mean, they look like Bing cherries. I mean, it's the size of them. I thought, I wonder how long these are going to stay on this branch. So I had them in my garage, which is like a walk-in cooler. So that probably helped. If they were indoors, they would, you can see they're starting to get a little bit brown. But some things really are.
That's a long time. They've been a month cut in different arrangements.
Right.
So are there? So that would be something to do. You sometimes think ahead. I'm going to cut these, save these, and I'll be able to use them for the next few weeks.
Yes, especially in the spring, when we get into like late February, early March, and people have all their flowering trees that need to be pruned. That, you know, everything from the flowering cherries to
That part's easy because you got all the flowers. It's coming. I'm curious about winter when you have so few things.
Well, I cut stuff when it's just started, the bud is starting to swell. Like right now, my, the one that's sort of interesting is the verbena pink dawn is already starting to bloom. And I think it's because normally it blooms in January. I think it's because we've had semi-mild weather. So all the leaves are off. It's got these very scented, tiny pink flowers. I'm thinking about bringing that indoors.
Oh, that'll be nice.
But, you know, the evergreens will last indoors for a couple weeks, so that gets you through winter. January is a little dreary, to be honest with you.
Do you do other? Well, you can have just blank twigs. You can have twig bouquets.
Oh, very modern, very contemporary.
Just dogwood and other maples. Do you ever use maples in?
I love using vine maple in the fall, but right now the leaves are kind of dropping. But earlier, when they just start to turn color, that's a great time to grab those branches. Beautiful. Maples have just such an interesting leaf that you could just put those in a vase. We had a big conference last week for the cut flower growers all over the country and Canada. They were all here in Tacoma for a few days, which was really great. And someone made an arrangement of a big urn of branches of red maple, and added huge succulents, aeoniums, that one that's called Schwarzkopf, dark purple. And it was like two worlds colliding in a vase. It was stunning. And the leaves will die, but the succulents will live on.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's another thing. You can definitely cut your houseplants up.
Cut your houseplants up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that's sort of a way
to cheat. That's an interesting idea. That's interesting. I like that cheat, though.
Yeah.
Because they get big anyway, so you're just going to...
Yeah, and I was just noticing, like, if I needed ferns, for example, for a floral project, I would buy them at the garden center, cut the leaves off of the pot, use the beautiful fronds, but then I could still take that crown and go plant it in the garden and sort of get two purposes out of one plant.
That's great.
Yeah.
Deborah Prinzing is talking with us while those slackers are on vacation, Willie Galloway and Greg Rayburn and Marty Wingate. No, of course they're not slackers, and I'm glad you're here. All right, so here, I don't know if we know the answer to this question, JC, in Des Moines, but I thought you should ask it just so we can hear your excitement about it. You have a hazelnut tree?
Yeah, I realized after I called in that this probably was the wrong week to ask this question.
What do you mean? Give me a try.
No. It could be great. I've had these hazelnuts for 5 years, and wisterias, but that's another. And so I just wonder how long it takes before you get nuts or the wisteria will start to bloom.
How long have you had the wisteria?
About 5 years.
Have you pruned it at all, or are you just kind of letting it do its thing?
I have pruned it, but it's gotten huge. I mean, it's 20 feet.
And is it the type that gets flowers before the foliage or after the leaves have come out? There's a Japanese variety and a Chinese variety.
It's the purple kind that is supposed to smell really good.
Yeah. Right. My experience with a wisteria is that they are like long-lived vines. I had a 40-year-old wisteria. So, you may need to be patient, but I think the master gardeners might have some better advice for you, but I would wonder if you fertilized it at all? Because if you are trimming it and pruning it, you're at least forcing growth down into the roots.
That seems like a long time from my lack of knowledge. That seems like a long time.
Yeah, it does. And I don't know. I don't know whether,
But somebody's going to write us. I figured somebody's going to know the answer to that question, JC. So they can write us or post on our Facebook page weekday on KUOW. And I don't know the answer about how long it takes for filberts.
Well, I have a friend who's a chestnut tree farmer in Port Townsend, and her chestnuts did not bear fruit for 10 years. And I don't know if nuts just have that proclivity in Western Washington to need more dry conditions. And a lot of our nut crops are in Eastern Washington.
But I'll tell you what, hazelnuts that haven't quite ripened would be great in a bouquet.
Yes, they would. And there's that whole sort of secondary industry out of Oregon where the hazelnut shells are sold for mulch and path material. So,
all right, let's make some bouquets.
Make a comment on Facebook and I'll look all those up and email you.
All right, JC is Weekday on KUOW on Facebook, and I appreciate that. And Deborah Prinzing, garden, home, and design writer. Her book is The 50-Mile Bouquet. This one was about 180 miles, but it...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.